Clarence Darrow is probably best remembered for defending John Scopes in the famous monkey trial of 1925 and Leopold and Loeb in what was then called the trial of the century. But throughout the early 20th century, Darrow was famous or infamous for defending people accused of anarchism, socialism, and political crimes associated with their beliefs. A new biography by John Farrell called Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, tells the story of America's most controversial defense lawyer. It is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased to welcome Johnny Farrell to our show today.
And I'm very pleased to be here.
Where did he come from? Was his family the sort that produced lawyers and other professionals?
He actually came from a small town in northeast Ohio, from a family of abolitionists. They were sort of the town cranks. His dad was a small shop owner who loved to read, had flirted with the idea of going into the ministry, and had lost his faith, and so was what was known then as a free thinker. And his mom was an early believer in giving women the right to vote. And so he was brought up to be iconoclastic from the beginning.
And he obviously turns out to be very much the child of his parents. You say he was an avid reader. Jefferson, Thomas Paine, Tolstoy?
Yes. Darrow liked nothing better than to do than to sit with a few friends around the living room, open a book, and then he loved to read aloud to them. In his apartment in Chicago, he knocked down several walls to create a huge living room that was lined on all sides with bookshelves to hold all the various books and tomes and series that he had collected over the years.
What was his formal education like?
It was not very good. He went to the University of Michigan for 1 year to the law school and dropped out. He had had a little bit of college before, or pre-college before the Great Depression of 1893 forced him to 1873 forced him to drop out of college. So basically, he got his training and his expertise by what was then known as reading for the law. You got a lawyer in Youngstown, Ohio, to hire him as a clerk, and the lawyer agreed to instruct him. And then he went to the local tavern one night and sat down with the local lawyers who were the bar examiners, and they all had a very congenial evening. And the next day, he was a lawyer.
After 1 year of law school.
After 1 year of law school.
I bet you there are a lot of law students right now who wish you could do that today. You characterize him as someone with mixed feelings about being financially comfortable. Did he make a lot of money over the course of his career?
He made and lost a lot of money. He had a horrible sense for investing. He was always investing in gold mines or Central American railroads or whatever scheme came along. And then he managed to put a little bit of money aside and then lost it again in the great crash of October 1929. So for all his entire life, there was this great tension between Darrow, the great generous liberal lawyer, and Darrow, sort of the scheming attorney who had to keep the law office running and collect good fees and take on some pretty unsavory characters from time to time when he needed money. And that included some of Chicago's more famous gangsters. And there's a reason why the movie Chicago, the character Billy Flynn, is based on Clarence Darrow, because he represented a lot of those gals who shot their husbands because he had it coming.
But he also defended powerful corporations against the people we normally think of as his typical clients.
Yes,
so he was all over the place. Did people question that at the time?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. People throughout his entire life, they were always frustrated by Darrow because he really had his own set of moral guidelines that frustrated whether they were anarchists or socialists or businessmen on the other side. He was never dependably comfortable with any ism. He was always a skeptic.
For example, he switched sides in a labor dispute against Ogden Gas and Cosmopolitan Electric. How did he defend himself for doing that?
He wrote this amazing letter in that particular instance to somebody who was one of the ladies at the Hull House, which was the famous halfway house in the Chicago inner city.
Well, he was a friend of Jane Addams.
He was a friend of Jane Addams, and one of her friends, Ellen Starr, had written him a letter saying, "How could you do stuff like this?" And he wrote back and he said, "Look, I came from a small town, and I came here to the big city with the desire that I was going to overturn the apple cart and change things. And I can't do it unless I have an income. And so I'm going to work within the system to destroy the system." And so whether or not you can sort of accept that brand of idealism, that was his creed, and he followed it all the way through.
My guest is John A. Farrell, a longtime journalist who's currently a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity. He's the author of the best-selling book, Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. And we're talking about his latest, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, which is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've called your introduction Jefferson's Heir. Was Darrow particularly fond of Jefferson, considering the fact that his parents were abolitionists and Jefferson had owned slaves?
because Jefferson by that time was the supreme idol or the supreme icon, I guess, for individual liberty. And if there was one word that you would have to use to capture Darrow philosophically, it was a libertarian. He was a social libertarian more than an economic libertarian that we're familiar with today. But he just generally believed that that once human beings got into something big, whether it was government or whether it was industry, the individual suffered. And that applied to the death penalty when it was government, and it applied certainly when he was defending the labor movement against the robber barons in the 1890s.
But would we call him a man of the left today? You write that he fell in with the Democrats.
I would say he was. I mean, he was a lifelong Democrat, but he was, and certainly no Republican. But he would have fit very well into sort of the '60s generation because he believed in personal liberty much more than he believed in, say, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt or the New Deal.
But when you say he's a libertarian, you're not talking about Ron Paul. You're talking about the '60s kinds of libertarians.
Yes,
and he was. What was his association with the ACLU?
Well, you know, one of the amazing things about Darrow is that he was a founding attorney for both the ACLU and the NAACP, and you probably could have written a biography about him just for those two achievements. In the case of the ACLU, Darrow supported World War I, and the left did not. The left saw it as a conspiracy of the industrialists to pit the working class against each other. But Darrow was very suspicious of Prussian militarism, and in fact, 20 years later, he would be one of the leading and early voices warning America about Nazism. But his leftist friends never forgave him for supporting World War I, and he went around and joined with industrialists and with Woodrow Wilson, went around the country with Sam Gompers, the head of the AFL, making speeches to defend the war and America's entry into the war.
Well, we mentioned he was a friend of Jane Addams, who was a feminist, sociologist, an activist for world peace. So did they disagree on this sort of thing?
Yes, she was one of the leftists or pacifists who really disagreed with him on the issue of World War I.
Although I imagine he made his share of enemies throughout his life. He's been quoted as saying, "I have never killed anyone, but I have read some obituary notices with great satisfaction." What were some of the obituaries he might have enjoyed?
Oh, I think that he probably would have enjoyed most of the Supreme Court from the 1880s and the 1890s. Certainly, at the end of his life, when he was warning America about Nazism, he actually suggested that the world would be better off if somebody would assassinate Hitler. So he knew his tyrants pretty well. He defended in New York. He defended Italian anarchists who opposed Mussolini in a series of a couple of trials in the 1920s. Pretty much anybody who was a bully. Those were the guys whose obituaries he would have liked to read.
So it did matter to him whether or not his clients were guilty or at least working for a cause that he felt was worthwhile?
No, his entire sort of moral universe revolved around motive. And he didn't believe that a bunch of lawyers sitting in a corrupt legislature in Springfield or Albany actually knew what was right and wrong or what was best for society, but that individuals under the tremendous stress that they were under really had to make very difficult choices. And his whole courtroom appeal to juries was always built around context. You know, put yourself in this man's place. Look at the pressures that he was under. Look how his heart was torn by this love affair. Look about how he was driven to distraction because he couldn't support his family. Think again. Think one more time about what you would do in this man's place. And so context was everything to Darrow, and he had really no use at all for what he called the strictures of the good people.
Well, would he have taken a case like the Casey Anthony case?
Sure. And I'm not sure that he would have taken it enthusiastically, but he certainly would have had no objection to it. He defended some really rotten people. One of my favorite was a woman named Emma Simpson, who walked into a divorce court, pulled a revolver out, and shot her husband right there in court. And Darrow argued with the classic definition of chutzpah that the jury should feel sorry for the widow and got her off.
Well, did he try to prove that the thrill killers, Leopold and Loeb, were not guilty, or just that they shouldn't be executed for their crime?
In the case of Leopold and Loeb, who were really despicable creatures and faced widespread condemnation in Chicago, especially in the press, the big issue was whether, for Darrow, was the death penalty. They were both still teenagers, and he just believed so much against the death penalty, and particularly against the idea of applying it to young men, that he said were sort of tossed in the passions of adolescence.
They were in their 20s. They weren't exactly adolescents.
Well, I think they were 18 and 19, yeah. Were they not? Yeah.
Oh.
They probably were in their 20s by the time that they went to jail. But they were they were brilliant young men. They were they had been promoted through college. They were they just did this incredibly despicable act. What they as they said, for the thrill of it, they killed a young boy from the neighborhood. And Darrow's genius was to plead them guilty, but I guess as Bruce Springsteen used to say, guilty with an explanation. And he asked to present the mitigating evidence, put on a bunch of psychologists. But basically it came down to the idea as to whether or not society does better by executing young men in this condition, or whether society just merely sort of encourages the notion of savagery by doing so.
Is he still controversial? The review of this book elicited a lot of letters to the New York Times Book Review.
I think he is, because I read an argument the other day in a magazine that blamed the riots in London on him because he was the person who created the image of personal responsibility. Crumbled or defeated the image of personal responsibility. With his argument about context and his argument about motive, he sort of took the idea of sin out of the equation. And so conservatives to this day still don't like him. Of course, they don't like him at all for arguing that you should not bring religion into the public schools in the Monkey Trial. And they don't like him because he opposed the death penalty so vehemently throughout his life. And, of course, they don't like him because of the long history of involvement with the labor movement.
And we'll get back to some of those issues when we come back to this discussion. My guest is John A. Farrell. His latest book, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. It's published by Doubleday. Stay with us. We're back with John A. Farrell, whose biography, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, is published by Doubleday. Part of what made him so compelling was his skill as an orator. What was it like to watch a Darrow trial?
I think if you went back to the movies, he was not quite as flamboyant as Spencer Tracy in Inherit the Wind, probably more like Orson Welles in Compulsion. He was sort of down home. He put the thumbs behind those suspenders, walk up to the jury rail, look the folks in the eye, and talk to them. He always said that he never addressed the jury. He talked to them. And he would reason, and he would jump into his flights of great oratory and wave his hands at the heavens and bring that palm smashing down in the fist smashing down into his palm. But then it was always back again to a sort of a gentle waving of his spectacles and a more reasonable approach.
But you quote him as saying to another attorney, "Toms, you aren't treating me fair in this case. You're so darn nice, I can't get going." Would it be fair to say that Darrow thrived on conflict?
Yes, he always, one of his courtroom tricks, he could pass on to young lawyers listening, was always to have a villain in the courtroom that the jury could readily identify as the bad guy. And if at the end of the trial the bad guy was still your client, then you lost. But if you could force it to be the prosecutor or you could force it to be a prosecution witness, then you were a long way towards winning the case.
He was based in Chicago for most of his life, and he worked at City Hall for a time. What did he do there?
This was in Chicago's really wide-open era. The city went from like 30,000 to a million people in 3 decades, and that's when Darrow arrived there. And within 2 or 3 years, he had risen to become not just what they call the corporation counsel, who would ran the city's affairs, but also a key advisor to mayors, and finally a political captain and advisor to John Altgeld, who was the governor of Illinois.
But the mayor, Carter Harrison, was one of his bosses. And he went on to defend Patrick Prendergast, who assassinated Harrison. How did that come about?
Well, that's a great example of sort of Darrow's moral flexibility that drove some people crazy. Prendergast was obviously insane, and Darrow could not sit on the sidelines and watch the city of Chicago move on and hang this sort of babbling lunatic who had assassinated the beloved mayor. And so
was he beloved, Harrison? Was he a good
Carter,
mayor?
Oh, yes. Carter Harrison was, I guess, probably the equivalent of LaGuardia in New York, one of the great, great Chicago figures.
How common was an insanity defense at that time?
It was not very common, and Darrow did as well as he could. His fellow lawyers had several early victories, but in the end they lost him. And interestingly enough, of the scores of death penalty cases that he took, this was the only one that I could find that he lost where his client was executed.
Well, Harrison's son ran a newspaper. I suspect the cards were stacked against him. But Darrow also invoked God's will as a defense. Given his later role in the Scopes trial, it kind of surprises me that he would do that.
It's very interesting. He was a great admirer of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which is a very fatalistic poem. And so his argument to the jury, he'd obviously been reading the Rubaiyat because he quoted segments of it in his argument to the jury. And his argument to the jury was, don't blame the cracked pot. Blame the potter. For some reason, God has given us this flawed vessel, and it's not for us to destroy it because of God's strange ways and wisdom that we don't understand. There's a reason even for Prendergast. That's in sharp contrast to Darrow in his later years when he was known as one of America's most famous atheists, although I probably would more accurately call him an agnostic.
He ran for Congress. On what party?
He ran for Congress as a Democrat. At that time, though, the Populist Party was growing in the Midwest, and he was a key figure in trying to bring populism into the cities.
But the Democrats were the party of William Jennings Bryan.
Yep, the Democrats were the party of William Jennings Bryan. That was that same election year. And, in fact, part of the reason he may have lost was that he may have spent too much time campaigning for Bryan and not enough in his district.
And then later they wind up opposing each other in the Scopes trial.
They did. Darrow, I think, always was jealous of Bryan, always was a little bit contemptible of him, thought he didn't deserve the position that he had, and was not a very good champion intellectually for the common man, even though as an orator, Bryan was certainly Darrow's equal.
Would Darrow have gotten into trouble these days because of his family life?
Well, I don't know. I think Americans have asked this question a lot because there's a lot of Darrow fans say, why do you have to put all that stuff about all the love affairs and the money and the jury bribing in the book? And my sort of philosophy is after the last 40 years of watching our icons sort of get besmirched, I think that we're ready for real people rather than having to see sort of a sanctified version of them.
Well, Twitter wasn't around in those days. Eugene V. Debs' imprisonment was another one of his high-profile causes. What was his strategy for defending Debs?
In the Debs case, there were two cases. One of them he lost, which was a contempt case, which it's very, very hard to persuade a judge who's found somebody in contempt that he should reverse his own ruling, and so he lost that one. But and the other one was a jury trial, and he had much more success, and again, he sort of followed the philosophy of turning the case against the prosecution and making the prosecutor and the robber barons, putting them on trial rather than Debs.
In this case, the Pullman Company, was it mentioned in the trial that Darrow had formerly been employed by a railroad company?
I'm not sure it was mentioned in the trial, but everybody certainly knew it. And, you know, in those days, people were not quite as holy as we are now about hypocrisy. I found a few newspaper editorials who pointed out that, you know, Darrow, the voice of the common man, wasn't making these arguments, you know, back when he was working for the railroad. But I also found one wonderful newspaper editorial which said that, you know, Darrow used to work, you know, he's a labor lawyer, but he used to work for corporations. Now he used to work for the lawyer. And the great mystery is why this young man, when he finally landed such a wonderful plum position, why did he give it up? Why did he stay true to his beliefs and quit it and become a labor lawyer? So it was a very rambunctious and much more complicated set of political parameters in those days.
And a lot of contradictions. You write that the newspapers discussed magnificently attired women blazing with diamonds who had come out to see Darrow make his case at the Supreme Court. Well, we're talking about Clarence Darrow, whose image was as a class warrior. Did he have many supporters among the wealthy?
No, I think he had many supporters among the women.
So he was seen as very attractive?
He had a sort of a rough charisma. One of the ladies that I quoted said that he had the charisma, the attraction of what the French call of the devil, which is not classically handsome, but because he was a weathered looking fella. But altogether, just a charismatic figure when you examine the package as a whole, and of course, quite a wolf. So I think women picked up on that.
You mentioned his support of U.S. involvement in World War I, but he lived through a period we now talk about as the beginning of American imperialism. How did he feel about the United States' involvement in the Philippines?
He was definitely against it, and in fact, he had called Theodore Roosevelt a murderer in public. For the role that Roosevelt played in charging up San Juan Hill and as the great imperialist president.
He also defended a number of people who engaged in political violence. There was a bomb in a building owned by the L.A. Times that killed 21 people. He defended Bill Haywood, who was accused of the Bunker Hill bombing. Was he doing that because he supported their politics in any way?
He was, at that time, America's leading labor lawyer, and whenever Gompers needed him for a case like that, they would summon him, and he sort of felt compelled both for the affection that he had for the working man and his allegiance to the AFL to take these cases, even though they were, in many cases, thought to be unwinnable. And in many cases, he came through and he won them. Particularly, Bill Haywood was probably his great union triumph. Even the Los Angeles case, where he represented the McNamara brothers, who had been charged with blowing up the Los Angeles Times, was a victory in that he saved them through a very controversial plea bargain. But he did save them from the gallows. Labor was not satisfied with that because they wanted a clear win, or they wanted the brothers to be hanged so that they would be martyrs. So they weren't really happy with the solution that Darrow found.
You mentioned that he was a founding director of the NAACP, and you write about the divide in the black communities at the time between supporters of leaders like Booker T. Washington and more militants like W.B. Du Bois. Where did Darrow come down on that?
Oh, definitely with the militants. And Du Bois was a good friend of his. What I think was Darrow's greatest case was the trial of Dr. Ossian Sweet in Detroit. It was the fall after the Great Monkey Trial, and Darrow could have had any case for any great fee that he wanted in the country at a time when he needed money because he was approaching retirement in those days with no Social Security and didn't have a lot of money. And he took this case for $5,000 for the NAACP to defend a dentist and his family and friends whose house had been surrounded by a racist mob in Detroit, throwing stones, breaking windows, and the African-Americans had fired, killed one member of the mob, and Darrow went and took that case to establish the principle. It's hard to believe has to be established, but to establish the principle that a black man had a right to self-defense as well as a white man.
He eventually found himself on trial. What was he put on trial for?
That was an outgrowth of the McNamara trial in Los Angeles. And in the course of trying to save the McNamara brothers, he was standing across the street when his investigator was arrested, passing a bribe to one of the jurors. And so Darrow was prosecuted for twice for bribing two different jurors in that trial. In the first case, he got off with not guilty. The second case, it was a hung jury. The total effect of that two-year period in Los Angeles was that he came back to Chicago penniless with no legal practice, and his status as the leading labor lawyer had been dashed. And so that's where you get Darrow sort of putting the pieces together and becoming the criminal defense lawyer that we now know.
But he had been engaged in bribery and got off.
Most likely. We'll never be sure, but I certainly reached that conclusion when I was finished doing the research.
Now, you drew upon a lot of previously unpublished letters that Darrow wrote. Where did you find them?
I found them at the University of Minnesota, and it's a wonderful story. There's a letters collector named Randy Teachin who lives in Minneapolis, and he went to Chicago before Darrow's granddaughter passed on a few years ago and said, you know, do you have any letters from Darrow? And she said, well, let's go down the basement. And they went down the basement, and they rummaged a bit, and they pulled down one box that said Christmas ornaments, and they opened it up, and inside were 1,000 letters that had gone back and forth between Darrow and his family and between famous people like Woodrow Wilson and Jane Addams that hadn't been seen by researchers. They eventually ended up at the University of Minnesota Law Library, and they became open to scholars last summer.
Any surprises there?
I think so. I think that one of my favorite letters from that collection was one to one of his jurors in his bribery trial, or was actually to his son, instructing his son to send money to that juror from the bribery trial, sort of raises the idea that he bribed a jury in his bribery trial.
The New York Times reviewed your book along with another biography of Darrow by Andrew Karsten. At the risk of starting an argument, how do you feel about his book, and how do you think Clarence Darrow, which one of the biographies do you think Clarence Darrow would have preferred?
Well, I'm not going to touch the second part, but Andrew's book he's a scholar. He's a labor scholar at the University of Wisconsin, and it's a more scholarly, analytical book. I think all the reviews agree that if you want to sort of ponder the political theory behind Darrow's life, go to Andrew, and if you want a more cinematic version of the great trials and the rapes and murders and not guilty verdicts, then you might want to try mine.
Well, you do like to write about colorful figures. Tip O'Neill was your last subject. Now you have Clarence Darrow.
And thank you for having me on both times.
And where do you go from here?
You know, I don't know. I think I may want to try to do something about sort of following up the theory of Darrow and the robber barons in the Gilded Age and sort of examine what's happening to working men and women today in America, because I ran across so many comparisons of those days.
John,
and today.
Thank you so much. Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, is published by Doubleday. I look forward to speaking to you about that new book.
Take care.